Wow, that was just a wonderful introduction. Thank you, Daryl. So good morning, everyone. It's a real pleasure to be here as today's keynote speaker. As Daryl said, I'm the Executive Director of Tamarack Recovery Center, and we're an accredited in-house treatment center that provides addiction treatment and recovery services, including transitional housing, to adults in the Winnipeg and Manitoba community. And while I've had many years of training as a therapist, my process of learning about addictions and recovery happened on a much deeper level, on the job as it were, as I accompanied and witnessed individuals doing the work of recovery. Those participants were generous with me to share their stories and their experiences, and they allowed me to partner with them as they worked to heal from trauma, create new ways of coping, and create a life worth living. So today I'll be sharing some of my thoughts and information about the barriers that marginalized Manitobans face when it comes to substance use and recovery. And I'm accompanied by my colleague Joanne, who has kindly agreed to be part of the question and answer session afterwards. So while the setting of a wonderful breakfast and glasses of mimosas may not be the most obvious place to talk about addiction, you know what? I think it's a great one. Why? Because it seems that finally our community is starting to name what's been here and what's been needing our attention for a very long time. We're starting to look at how we're impacted by it. We're starting to look at how our community is holding up to it. And we're looking at how we can be part of a solution. This actually feels really different from many years ago. When I first started at Tamarack 14 years ago, addictions truly felt like they were something in the shadows. It felt like the best we could do and we could hope for was to help our participants to address the stigma that they experienced as it played out in their lives and try to support them in accessing funding for treatment places. And while our community still struggles with adequate funding to do this work, it's been encouraging that all levels of government, as well as citizens in our community, are now actually talking about and addressing this issue and tackling the stigma around it. And I don't mean encouraging in a, aw, that's really nice kind of way, but more in a, it's about damn time kind of way. I'm grateful to be part of this opportunity as a way of sharing some of my knowledge and experience with you all this morning, in the hopes that with greater awareness, we can all feel more informed and empowered to make a difference. But before we look at barriers to accessing treatment and to experiencing recovery, let's back things up. I want to first look at and consider how a person even becomes addicted. We didn't come into this world either destined to be an addict or not. So what happens that can lead a person down that path? Well, there's lots of theories, and one we base our treatment program work on recognizes how our basic humanity, our drive or our wiring, if you will, can impact our use of behaviors and substances as a way to meet our needs and cope with life. So the idea is that we have 12 basic needs. These are pleasure or avoiding pain, food and water, sex and procreation, love, relationships, security, purpose, rest, beauty, moments of wow or awe, and some kind of spiritual connection. Meeting these needs gives us satisfaction. If all these needs are met consistently, I feel a sense of being content and complete. But sometimes needs aren't missed, say through trauma or losses or parental absences, maybe through death, divorce, working more than one job, or mental health challenges. And also through the experience of poverty. Missing needs leaves us discontent. It leaves us feeling less complete and not whole. And speaking of missing needs, have you been counting? Is there someone in the audience thinking, there's one left, she only got to 11? If so, good for you. The 12th need is the need to feel content or whole or satisfied. And this is such a fundamental need that if we don't have it, our brain will drive us to find solutions to getting it. And this is where the risk of addiction comes in. See, often the solutions that we come up with to meet our needs aren't actually what we really need. Our solution can then end up being the problem. So, for example, if I didn't have my need for a sense of value met in a healthy way, I might try to meet it in less healthy ways. That might look like people-pleasing or trying to be the best at something. And you know what? I might actually feel whole for a while. I might feel good. But the solution will eventually fail as it doesn't really provide me what I need, which is to actually feel good about myself. It doesn't address the fact that I secretly feel lousy about myself and I'm burning myself out trying to get approval from everyone. Another way of looking at it is it's kind of like trying to meet a thirst for water with coffee. At first, I might feel satisfied, but eventually, I'm going to get thirstier and thirstier and ultimately end up dehydrated. So the needs I have are healthy, but they're being met in a healthy way, in an unhealthy way. Our brain kind of gets its wires crossed. So I might think, well, if I'm feeling sad or anxious or lonely, for example, I need social media or a drink or distraction, which might be the wrong thing and potentially addictive. At some point, we may find that one or more of these needs, say the need for pleasure or to feel connection or relaxed or to avoid pain, is being met when we use substances. Well, suddenly I'm not shy. Suddenly I feel relaxed. I'm feeling good. I'm having fun. I don't hurt. I belong. And in that instance, we've got a psychological and behavioral thing happening. But what we also have is a physical thing. So check this out. How many of you have heard about the dopamine release in the brain whenever drugs or alcohol or food is consumed? Dopamine, right on. Dopamine is sometimes called the pleasure chemical. It's a reward chemical that's designed to motivate us to do things that will ensure the survival of the species. So two big and important things being eat, have sex. However, when we mess with that, we start to use those things for ways other than how they were designed. And when we introduce other substances, that could cause a hike in our dopamine levels and put us at risk of addiction. So I'd like you to picture numbers on a graph from 0 to 3. Okay, I've gone really low tech today, so I'm relying on your imaginations. So we've got 0 to 3. So from doing nothing to a pleasurable activity, you can go from about a 0 to a 2. From doing nothing to the most amazing day with your dream person, eating your dream foods, you may even hit a 3. But introduce crack or meth, and you go from a 0 to a 10 or a 12 in dopamine release. Now, I get it, this might sound exciting, but get this, your brain is designed to run on a 0 to 2 level of dopamine. So you're asking it to work beyond its capacity for processing dopamine. And so here's what it does. It goes into panic mode. It shuts down the dopamine factories because there's way too much being made. So the next time you go to use, you find it takes more to get the same result. Your brain changes chemically. It can't handle that level of dopamine. So with continued use, what felt like a 12 on the first use slowly starts to feel like an 8, then a 5, then a 2, then a 0. However, because your brain has changed chemically, if you're feeling a 0 when you're high, how do you think you're feeling when you're not high? Way lower than a 0. And now you're needing the substance just to feel normal and just to function. And over time, you need more and more just to feel okay. So what happens when you quit? A couple big things. One, you get huge cravings. Your brain actually believes you're in danger without this substance, just like you'd be in danger if you didn't have water for a couple days. Your brain believes it's gonna die. So your brain creates an obsession or a massive drive for you to seek this out and get it no matter what. One way of understanding this is it's kind of like a mirage in the desert. It's not real, yet many a person who is dying of thirst will see what they imagine to be a source of water, and they will pull themselves towards it no matter what. It's kind of like that drive and desperation. What also happens when you quit? Well, you feel like crap. And now there is a technical term for this, and it's called anhedonia. An meaning less, hedonia meaning pleasure or pleasureless. So while your brain recalibrates, dopamine levels are very low, and you can expect to struggle to feel pleasure or joy in the same way that you did prior to using, or even in the early days of using. However, while the brain will heal, and within 3 to 6 months, dopamine levels begin to return to normal, it can take around a year or more before your brain fully returns to its pre-substance use and functioning. So during that time, recovery becomes about finding new ways to meet your needs, and over time, training your brain to form new circuits so that you can use new skills to cope. So rather than, I feel pain, I want to use, I'm under stress, I just need a drink, I'm socializing at a party, let's get high, your brain is being challenged to build new circuits time and again. And it's going to feel clunky and awkward and not me, but you have to do it enough times for it to feel natural and part of you. And all of this takes time. Not the 28 days of a standard treatment program, or even the 78 days that Tamarack's program offers. How long do you think it takes? About 2 years. And sometimes longer to recalibrate dopamine and other pleasure chemicals and build new circuits. So now we've got a bit of an understanding about some of the theories of why we become addicted. Let's look at some of the pervasive myths that abound when we talk about addictions and the people experiencing them. It's these myths that have helped to preserve the stigma and status quo around addiction treatment and recovery funding. And I encourage you to have a think about how many you might have believed at one time or other. And please, don't worry. This is for your reflection only, and I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. So myth one, they made the choice to use substances. It's their fault they became addicted. The overwhelming majority of people with an addiction have experienced significant trauma in their lives, and they began using substances as a way to manage the resulting pain and overwhelming feelings. Drugs and alcohol affect the balance of chemicals in the brain, so the more a person uses substances, the more their brain depends on it to feel normal. It's a chemical dependence, not a character defect. Myth two, if they wanted to stop, they would. They lack willpower. When substance abuse turns into dependence, it takes a powerful hold over the mind and body. Even the strongest-willed individuals need support in withdrawing from the effects of drugs or alcohol and rebuilding a life without substances. This can come in the form of treatment centers like Tamarack. Myth three, addicts are poor, uneducated, and homeless. As we talked about earlier, some of the things that can lead a person to become addicted have more to do with environmental influences, trauma, mental health, stress, and parental substance abuse. However, although there is not a causation between poverty and drug use, there is a correlation. Why is this? Well, the most commonly accepted hypothesis is that a person living in poverty increases the number of risk factors that they're surrounded by. And a risk factor in this case is anything that increases a person's chance of addiction. Poverty increases stress. Worrying about how to afford shelter, food, other basic needs causes a tremendous amount of stress and increases temptation to turn to drugs or alcohol to escape from problems. Poverty increases feelings of hopelessness. When meeting daily expenses is difficult, dreams of having a home, opening a business, or traveling the world seem impossible. Feeling as though you're powerless over your own future can create a vulnerability to substance abuse. Poverty decreases self-esteem. In a culture that values material possessions and financial success, being poor can feel like a moral failing. This can lead to feelings of guilt, shame, and diminished self-worth. Poverty increases the risk of mental illness, and
mental illness increases the risk of drug addiction. The Mental Health Foundation of Great Britain determined that people living in the lowest 20% of incomes are 2 to 3 times more likely to develop mental health problems than those in the highest 20%. Mental health issues and other untreated disorders can also lead to self-medication, which can be a primary cause of addiction. Poverty decreases social support. Having the emotional support of friends and family helps people cope with difficult situations in their lives. However, lower-income adults are less likely to have a strong social network if they're expending their energy trying to survive from day to day, working extra jobs, working jobs at unsocial hours. Poverty and unemployment and addiction. Years' worth of data shows that addiction rates are twice as high among the unemployed than among those who have jobs. In many cases, the stress of unemployment leads to substance abuse. And what do we see at Tamarack? Well, over the past 10 years, an average of 50% of all individuals who come to Tamarack are unemployed when they enter our program. So the addiction and poverty cycle. Poverty can lead someone to use drugs, but drug use can also lead someone into poverty. There are many middle class and upper class individuals who've fallen into poverty because of their substance use. And once someone has a substance use disorder, it can be extremely difficult to maintain a stable economic status. Addictions are cumulative, meaning they will cost more to maintain as time passes. Drug addiction can cause people to miss work, perform poorly, and fail drug tests, and threaten their job security and employment. A common saying is that addiction doesn't discriminate. And it's true. Addiction can and does affect people from every sphere of life. We've seen this at Tamarack. But in another way, it can shine a light on the way the distribution of money, power, and resources can and will tip the scales against people who have the least access to them, and it puts them at greater risk of harm. Myth number 4, we should just leave them alone. They're only harming themselves anyway. In all our 47 years, Tamarack has never worked with an individual whose addiction has not impacted somebody. Untreated addictions cost society millions of dollars a year. Workplaces suffer, families are torn apart, crime, violence, and trauma are perpetuated. We can't afford to ignore people with addictions because we believe they only affect themselves. The cost to all of us is too great. And finally, myth 5, it's hopeless. People who are addicted are a waste of time and money to deal with. One of our biggest struggles in securing support for those who cannot afford treatment is the myth that it won't work and that relapse is inevitable. Participants who have relapses, though, are not unsuccessful. Treatment for some people is an ongoing process and is successful if it improves their condition at that time. By coming to Tamarack, participants double their chances of recovery. Since 2013, our center has an average completion rate of 85%, which far exceeds the industry average of 44%. And our graduates report sobriety rates well above national norms. We know that in helping one person achieve recovery from addiction, we impact an entire network of individuals, families, children, friends, colleagues. This myth that a person with an addiction is a lost cause or a waste of money to deal with is perhaps the most damaging myth of all. So now we come to barriers to treatment. And by now, I bet you could probably name several of the barriers since they've been referenced throughout this talk already. Some of the more pervasive and challenging barriers to treatment can be financially based. Despite being a health issue, treatment is not always and actually very rarely free. And sometimes the cost can be prohibitive. Couple this with the fact that even if you want in-house treatment, you will likely be looking at signing off work, if you're lucky enough to have a job, for 1 to 2 months at least. Barriers can also be gender-based. By this, I'm talking about the number of treatment beds in the city or even in the province being more abundant for males than for individuals identifying as female. And just like the challenge of taking time off work for treatment, women in our society are still regarded as the main caregivers in the majority of families. So leaving the home and childcare responsibilities can be exceptionally challenging at best, if not impossible. Mental health challenges have historically been a significant barrier. Many treatment centers in the past would require a participant to have their mental health issues under control prior to seeking treatment. But in order to do that, many doctors would need to reassess and evaluate that person's medications, and so they want their substance use under control before doing that. So we've got a wonderful catch-22 situation here. So what are some ways we can address the barriers? Well, really, it's all about access. So for individuals with addictions and mental health challenges, this actually means taking what's called the no wrong door approach and addressing the first issue that they have sought help with, and then engaging external resources, say through case management or partnering with other healthcare organizations to address the other issues. And we've seen great success with this at Tamarack, as individuals are strengthened in their treatment by the resources that wrap around them to support them on all levels. For female participants, that means prioritizing access for those who are pregnant. It means seeking extra funding for women's treatment places. It means creatively looking at where and how women can prepare for treatment without having to attend a primary program where female spaces are few and far between. As an example, in Tamarack, this meant for us removing the requirement for a 28-day program prior to coming in. This because women were actually finding that they were waiting ages before being able to get into that 28-day program. Now we just ask people to have detox and we work with them in a pre-treatment capacity to provide that support. We can create more funded programs. This involves lobbying government for more funding, and for example at Tamarack, with an additional $200,000 a year, we could actually provide no-cost access to anyone needing treatment up to our full capacity. And honestly, when addictions cost Manitobans, all of us, $1.4 billion a year, funding treatment and recovery programs feels like a pretty reasonable investment. We can also work with donors who want to create equitable access for individuals. At Tamarack, donations from private philanthropy have facilitated access for over 40% of our treatment places. And just in case you're wondering, if treatment was funded, would everyone given a space take it seriously? Would everyone complete? Well, here's something to think about. Out of our funded participants in 2021, 88% completed our program. Right now, the number for 2022 is 100%. And in case you're wondering, is it worth it? Does it make a difference? 89% of our graduates right on graduation report that they completely agree with the statement that they have hope for the future, compared to 45% when they moved in. 89% completely agree that they're healthier, compared with 10% who said they were healthy when they moved in. These stats are typically where the story ends. We feel proud the person has gone to rehab, they've come out clean, and now they can get on with their life, right? We know it's far more complex than that. After treatment is where the hardest work begins and a new set of barriers to overcome emerges. People still need safety, a safe place to live, a place where there's no substance use, where they're able to afford rent in an area that feels safe. They need stability, connection, and a sense of purpose and security. And what we found is that while we can't, nor is it our role to be all things to all people, providing ongoing access to support in various forms helps individuals make the transition from in-house intensive treatment to a healthy life in recovery. Our way of doing that is to provide all our graduates with unlimited, no-cost recovery support through our aftercare program. This program focuses on lifestyle management to maintain long-term recovery. Additionally, for many years, we recognized that safe, affordable housing is a significant need for our participants. And in 2021, we launched The Branch, a family-style home in our neighborhood to provide access to next-step housing for participants who want that extra independence in a safe environment. In an industry where measuring success can not only be challenging but hard to define, we've endeavored to follow our participants after graduation, and we've learned that they build hopeful, productive, and thriving lives. 90% completely agree they have a sense of hope for the future. 95% completely agree they can achieve new goals. They also achieve significantly above average sobriety rates. In 4 surveys of the participants who responded, 93% were sober on the days the survey was taken, and 49% were sober since completing treatment, which ranged from 3 months to well over 10 years. So before I share a brief story that leads into our Q&A session, I want to point out that while you may have heard me reference Tamarack in these conversations, my choice to do this is simply because this is what I know firsthand. This is what I see on a daily basis. It's certainly not because Tamarack has the exclusive line on providing these services or removing barriers. There are many more organizations in the province working with far too little recognition and far too little funding alongside Tamarack to advocate for Manitobans and to restore hope and dignity to individuals experiencing addiction. Now I'm going to beg you for 5 or 10 more minutes so I can share a story that wraps up this portion of the keynote speech that pulls together some of the themes we've been talking about. It's a true story. It's about a woman, we'll call her Sheila, not her real name, and her journey through addiction and recovery. Sheila grew up in a home with a mom who was 15 and a dad who was 17 when she was born. And so the chances for those two young parents, who were essentially children themselves, to meet all of Sheila's needs were slim. By age 12, Sheila was essentially parenting her younger siblings, who at that time ranged from 2, 4, and 6 years old, respectively. Outside caretaking her siblings, Sheila found her value in trying to be the perfect child, the good girl, trying to be the best kid in any aspect a kid could. A relationship with her boyfriend from age 12 served as an escape and a second family. At age 16, she became pregnant and got married after her son was born. Sheila sought to create what she thought was the healthy family she had not grown up in, and she strived to be the best mom, the best wife, putting all her focus and energy into appearing to be the woman who had it together, who kept a perfect home with well-behaved kids. For the next 20 years, she raised 2 children, entered the workforce, and was quickly promoted to management roles in the business sector. She and her husband were able to buy a large home, and to the outside world, it looked like they were the epitome of success. However, by using success to meet her deep needs for value, security, and belonging, she wasn't meeting the needs in a healthy way. And as her kids grew up, she no longer had as much to focus on and to provide the structure and routine that would have made it more challenging to engage in addictive behaviors without consequence. It was at this stage in her life that, in Sheila's words, she went crazy. She was living the life she didn't have the chance to have lived because of parenting so early in her teen years. She found new friends who were exciting and daring, who drank a lot and smoked a lot of pot. After being so restrictive for so many years, trying not to be her dad or the many other relatives in her family with addiction, she thought she was safe. After all, who becomes an addict at age 35? However, it took Sheila no time at all to fall deep into addiction. In a short space of time, she went from partying with friends to becoming involved in another relationship, to leaving her husband, giving up her home, and having to face her children and say she didn't want to be a mom and a wife any longer. The subsequent years involved a more extreme level of addiction as guilt and shame dominated her everyday experience and prevented her from healing and creating this new life she'd been searching for. In the space of a few years, from being a person with a full-time job, their own home, and a family to be part of and care for, Sheila was homeless. She was sleeping on the streets, without a job, isolated not just from her immediate family, but her family of origin as well. She was hospitalized and nearly died many times because her body was shutting down. She would enter detox frequently, but upon discharge, would head right to the LC, and the cycle would repeat again. Now, Sheila did go to treatment. In fact, she went to a 28-day program 4 times. Did she fail because she kept returning? On the contrary, as she put it, it wasn't four times at treatment because I was that addicted or that weak. It was because I didn't have the knowledge I needed yet. As she says, you would think I would know something about addiction, having grown up with only addicts on each side of my family, but no one had ever gotten into recovery. So going into treatment was absolutely brand new. And the more education I got about me and my alcoholism, the more capable I was in staying sober. So what made the difference for Sheila? Well, treatment for sure, that sense of getting the full picture of what she needed to do to heal and stay sober. And also getting very involved with AA. Essentially, this met several really important needs. The need for connection, purpose, safety, value. And this is what Sheila needed as she rebuilt her life. That was 15 years ago. Sheila's story shows that when a person needs and wants treatment, if treatment is there, positive growth can happen. But the process isn't linear. The process is complex. For some, it's even been described as a sense of surrendering rather than striving and struggling. But I digress. We haven't quite finished with our story. So it was at the point 2 years into Sheila's recovery that she came to work at Tamarack as a care worker. She very quickly showed not only her knowledge and ability to work in this field, but her capacity to meaningfully connect with participants in the program. It wasn't long before she was then offered the senior care worker role, then the case manager and aftercare counselor role. And now she serves as our clinical supervisor and manager of our new transition home. And if you haven't worked it out yet, the story I've just shared with you is actually the story of Joanne, our clinical supervisor, and she very generously agreed for me to share it with you today. Thank you, Joanne. I hope what I've shared with you this morning has been informative and educational, and I hope you feel inspired to have some conversations with those you know about addictions and recovery in our community. Joanne and I are both happy now to answer any questions that you have. Thank you.
We don't have a roving mic, so if you have an outdoor voice for your question, that would go very well.
How many beds are at Tamarack?
So for the treatment program, we have 12 beds in total. And for the branch program that Joanne runs for transitional, we have 10.
How do we help? How does the average everyday person help?
Well, as we talked about, funding, of course, huge issue. But even the fact of learning more about addictions and being a voice in your community of friends, in your business communities and your social networks, that's huge. That's huge to get the word out there that help is there and that recovery is 100% possible.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that what you do at Tamarack and what others do in this field, sometimes you must still feel overwhelmed because of the volume of seemingly increasing need in this area.
Do you want to say anything about that? Here. Or I can. Okay.
We definitely, you do a lot of good hard work, but there's more and more people, asking for help and needing your time. So it can be, but I can speak for Tamarack. I mean, we are a smaller facility, so we are all so brilliant in helping each other out, so we can continue to do the work. And Lisa's an amazing leader, so that helps.
Here and there.
Okay, my name is Doug Wilson. I ran for mayor of Winnipeg in 2018. I ran on a platform guaranteed to fail because I talked about homelessness, addiction, poverty, and community. This year we had an election, and the present mayor, Gillingham, turned the tide on the election by shaming Glenn Murray for his weaknesses. I'm making that as just a step towards asking you, do you see any change at the municipal level? Do you anticipate any change at the municipal level to start dealing with this issue that is affecting every one of us in this room? I have lost people recently, very close to me, for reasons that shouldn't be if we were a community. Can I stop there and just ask you, do you see future in the present municipal government of helping you?
That's not a loading question, is it? I have to be optimistic. I have to be optimistic. I have to hope that people are willing to take the step towards being more progressive and put out some solutions that maybe 10 years ago felt bizarre or way too, you know, swinging towards one direction politically. We have got to look at any and all possible solutions. I hope this mayor does that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What is the access to services like Tamarack's in northern and rural Manitoba? Are those kinds of services accessible? What's the need like? And is the need even a little different because of settings?
Yeah, great question. I sit on an addictions network, a group of individuals, some of whom represent addictions treatment in the north. It is different. There are far fewer treatment facilities. Oftentimes people need the presence of a family doctor to even help get, you know, manage some mental health issues, or even just to say, yes, this person is fit enough to be in detox or to go to treatment. Where there's nursing stations instead of doctor's offices, that poses huge issues. And even just simply traveling, like we're so lucky in Winnipeg, we don't have to go far, but even just simply traveling to your nearest treatment center up north could be hours. So yeah, very, very different and lots of challenges there for sure, yeah.
We'll take time for one more question, and I think it was at this side of the room, please.
Great, thanks. This is more just, I just wanna get your opinion on this, but in the news and social media, there's a lot of opinions and not really sure how informed they are, but more in relation to like the legalization of drugs and safe injection sites. Some people say that can make the situation better, some say worse. I just wanna get your opinion on those topics.
Sure, and this is my opinion. I won't say I'm speaking for Tamarack when I answer this, but again, similar to what I was saying earlier, I think we have to look at other solutions, because right now what we have been doing isn't working enough. My personal view is having safe places for people to be, even if they're not where we think they should be, is far better than having them using and harming themselves on the streets, hidden in a basement. We've lost far too many people over the years who have had unintentional overdoses because they've not been in a safe place where somebody could help them if something went wrong. So I am all in favor of having safe spaces, absolutely.
Thank